Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, September 10th, 2025, we're delighted to host a litigation update on Dinner Table Action versus Schneider, an interesting case at the intersection of election law and free speech. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, I will keep my introduction of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than the careers would deserve, so I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us the Honorable Charles Miller, who serves as a senior attorney with the Institute for Free Speech. Mr. Miller joined IFS in 2023, and his work focuses on campaign finance, donor privacy, political speech, and freedom of the press. Mr. Miller also previously served as Ohio's Deputy Attorney General, where he directed their major litigation. And before joining the state AG's office as general counsel, he served as a judge for the First Appellate District of Ohio and also served as a visiting judge on the Ohio Supreme Court. Also joining us today as our moderator is Steve Klein, who is a partner at Bar Klein PLLC, where he advocates for the First Amendment rights of his clients against local, state, and federal regulators. Mr. Klein has published articles in several legal journals, and his commentary has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Times, the Detroit News, and other outlets. And I will leave it there. A last note, throughout the program, if you have any questions, please do submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Klein, the floor is yours.
Thanks a lot, Kayla, and thanks to the Federalist Society for having us today for this discussion. So I want to throw it out to you right at the outset, Chip, because people may not have done some research prior to this, which is completely understandable. So you're the lead counsel here for Dinner Table Action, and there are other plaintiffs in this case as well. Who are they, and what is their beef with the Maine Commission or the members of the Maine Commission on Governmental Ethics and Election Practices? And by beef, I mean other than the oxymoron governmental ethics.
Right. I represent Alex Titcomb and two PAC organizations that he's involved with. One, as you said, is Dinner Table Action, and a second is For Our Future. In Maine, they sort of have hybrid PAC situations where PACs can do both independent expenditures and also make contributions and sort of have separate accounts for that. And that's what Dinner Table does. The For Our Future PAC really just kind of collects money and then donates it to other PACs for independent expenditure or other uses. And so that's the clients. The issue that arose here is that in November 2024, there was an important election in Maine, you know, other than the national election, in which there was a ballot issue that was to place $5,000 contribution limits on contributions made for independent expenditures. It passed by over 70% of the vote, with the proponents like to talk about a lot and the state likes to talk about. On behalf of our clients, we at the Institute for Free Speech brought suit in December and got the state to agree immediately. We didn't even have to file a motion, agree immediately to hold the law and in abeyance pending resolution of the district court of the case there.
So just for those tuning in who don't have a background in campaign finance, to drive home here with what Chip was saying, is an independent expenditure is basically money that pays for election speech, right? So if you drive down a lot of TV ads that you'll see for, and you'll see the paid for by Dinner Table PAC, for example, or a radio ad. These are things that might support or oppose the election or a candidate, but they're paid for independently, right, by these organizations. This is as opposed to a contribution contribution to a candidate, him or herself, right, or to their committee. So you have this divergence that's at issue here. However, what we're talking about here, Chip, is, of course, contributions people make to the PAC, the money they give to the PAC so they can pay for these independent expenditures, right?
That's right. Yes. That's what we're talking about. And, you know, and again, there could also be coordinated expenditures, you know, for some entities, you know, but this is about truly independent expenditures, groups just going out doing their own thing.
So why did why would Maine just fold right away and agree to hold the law in abeyance?
Well, you know, so there's been some case law out there in this area already, you know, starting originally with Buckley versus Vallejo, that says that independent expenditures, you know, can happen. And then the Supreme Court underlined that in Citizens United, where, you know, they said there, you know, can be no restriction on independent expenditures. And then immediately on the heels of Citizens United, there was a case called speechnow.com .org that put out the standard that that we're talking about in this case, that because independent expenditures cannot be limited, independent contributions for independent expenditures cannot be limited either. And that was an en banc decision of the DC Circuit. So all 10 judges weighed in on that, and it was unanimous. And since then, since Speech Now, there have been several other circuit courts that have weighed in, all unanimously, all in the same direction. So in one sense, this is well-trodden ground. You know, there's no surprise that the district court ruled in our favor and ruled the law unconstitutional.
So the law never went into effect. It remains enjoined.
That's right. The district court enjoined it. And then the state and there are some interveners appealed. And so now it's pending at the First Circuit, which has not had one of these cases before, which is one of the reasons which was the reason why the proponents of the ballot initiative pursued this in Maine.
Now, so it's interesting to see in your complaint, and I think I've read this in some of the newspaper articles, but I didn't quite find it in the record. I mean, even the proponents of this bill stated, we know this is unconstitutional and we're passing it anyway, right?
Yeah, that's right. When they would have public meetings and they go around, you know, they say that, listen, you know, we know that the case law out there, you know, is very much against us. And, you know, we expect, you know, to lose in the district court. And, you know, and that's certainly what happened. You know, the sort of a chief spokesperson for the folks on their side on this is Larry Lessig, who is a founder of Equal Citizens, who's one of the interveners. He did a whole podcast series on this main ballot initiative. You know, in one of those, he said, you know, that they would not be surprised at all if the district court said, hey, every other federal appellate judge has ruled this unconstitutional. I'm going to do the same. And so they really shouldn't be surprised that that's what happened.
And so Equal, see, it wasn't just, you weren't just up against the AG's office in this case, right? The Equal Citizens actually intervened, and you had Neil Katyal on their behalf defending the law, right?
Yeah. Neil Katyal was got involved on there, you know, for them. And they brought in their own experts, one of which was basically a statistician. Who did some surveys of public citizens to get their reaction about setting contribution limits at different levels. And then they had two historians from Stanford who they got to talk about different aspects of what they called originalism.
What they called originalism. So now there's an originalist argument being posed in an attempt to overturn Speech Now, Citizens United, maybe even Buckley before that.
Yeah, that's correct. So that brings us kind of to why they brought this case, or why they brought the ballot initiative. You know, this is actually their third attempt at this. They sued the state of Alaska in state court, and got to the Supreme Court, tried to get something out of there to get to SCOTUS. It did not work. They tried a ballot initiative in Massachusetts before Maine. And there's a preclearance procedure, and the Attorney General, the state Attorney General, would not certify it to go on the ballot. So that's how we got to Maine. But what they want to do is they originally had one sort of constitutional argument that they wanted to make, and they've since added a second. And then the first one that they presented in Alaska and are presenting here is the forms of corruption should be constitutionally permissible for Congress or a state to regulate. Those that know this area of law, will know that the Supreme Court says for campaign finance, the only justification is to prevent either actual or apparent quid pro quo corruption. And they are asserting argument that originally founders were also very concerned about dependents corruption. And so they said that when in Buckley and the subsequent cases, when the courts talk about corruption, they're really not talking about the corruption at the founding, and they should be.
So what do they break down the difference between quid pro quo corruption and dependents corruption?
Yes, they do. With the original scholarship they did, they spent a lot of time talking about foreign dependence corruption, the idea that you could have individuals, candidates, government officials who somehow would be bribed by foreign officials and the like, And then they kind of went through the constitutional provisions that we got as a result of this, including the Emoluments Clause. yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. By doing that, what they proved, and I deposed their scholars. They were a bit shocked by this, I deposed them. And so I asked, Professor Rodkoff, isn't it true then that, as you go through and you show all these examples of how the founders address these forms of corruption that you're concerned about, or these that they were concerned about, that they've been addressed? And he's like, and he agreed. Yeah, yes, they have. And I asked him what it had to do with the First Amendment. And he said, little to nothing. That there's a bit of a disconnect between their argument and the provision of the Constitution that we have at stake here. So this dependence corruption wasn't necessarily tied to the First Amendment and how was it used at the time. So it doesn't seem that argument really will play in here, which is one of the reasons I call this so-called originalism, or their version of originalism.
Yeah, it does strike me, and my chuckle, arises from litigation that's now years old. Again, part of the new toolbox against all things Donald Trump, right? And we had this frequent litigation, the virtue of any kind of business interest abroad necessarily becomes some kind of emolument, and haven't heard about it in a while, right? But it's interesting to see it sort of pop up again. I guess I'd move from there. So is that the first originalist argument? Is there now another one coming to the fore?
Yes. Now there's a second one. And the second one is social contract theory. A lot of the historians of the time of the founding note that many of the founders were, very obsessed with the concept of social contract as being the way that which you form governments. And essentially what that is that government is formed by the agreement of the governed, You get together, and so you form this social contract that we will agree to be bound by the laws that are passed by the representatives that we elect. And where they take that in this case is they say that there's that, and then the second aspect of this argument is that the free speech clause was never intent to be enforceable. It was a statement of a natural right, and that under social contract theory, governments can restrict natural rights because they're doing so by the agreement and consent of the governed, because the governed elected the representatives. And what this is really doing in my mind is it's sort of taking the constitutional interpretation methods of, you know, the 70s and 80s and the Warren Court era of, hey, we're just going to look at these concepts and then we're going to, you know, abstract from them where they are, where to go about the wall. And so they're taking the concepts that were at play when the founders were forming governments in the states and at the federal level. And they're just applying those sort of writ large. And what they don't do is they don't engage with the actual text of the First Amendment. You know, Congress shall pass no law abridging the freedom of speech. They don't engage with the meaning of that.
You know, it's curious, too, that... And this has always been a problem with, you know, when the term gets thrown around, the goo-goos, right? Good government types, or be it, you know, the professional reform community at large, is always this, a level of disconnect that sort of surprises me, that what we're discussing here, particularly independent expenditures, right? The money to pay for political speech that supports, you know, and I mean explicitly, supports or opposes the election of a candidate, right? And to tell me, start squawking about social contract and, you know, even let's lay the text aside, which I think you've raised a great point there. Are you going to tell me that the 9 newspapers serving the city of Philadelphia, population 60,000 back in the late 1700s or during the founding era, it was just all they had to do was say, you can't spend this money, much money on ink because you're endorsing candidates? Is that really something that would have flown in the founding era?
You know, that they seem to think that it would have. And, you know, I think that, yeah. Listen, so whether when you have opponents of free speech and they can come from the right or the left, there are different ways they go about these things. But, you know, here... pretty much in the work that they did in this case, they disavowed originalism as their method of interpretation that they would use. So saying, I'm not an originalist, but if you were an originalist, this is what you'd have to believe. And, you know, and basically, you know, to answer your earlier question about how far, you know, how many other cases would they strike down? Well, essentially, under their version of originalism, which they do not adopt or agree with, the free speech clause would not be enforceable at all. It's not really related or restricted to campaign finance or political speech. It's just not enforceable. And you know, these type of arguments without limiting principles typically do not fare well.
So it's sort of an unseriousness being reflected not only in, you know, disconnect from reality, but even a disconnect from, you know, at some point, you know, this has been, you know, 15 years post Citizens United, about the same amount of time since Speech Now. Is it just, did you get the sense it's just like keep the merry-go-round going? You wonder, with Lessig himself, been in the game for about as long as, you know, post-CU as well.
So, no. I think what it is because they are not originalists, I don't think they necessarily take the originalism seriously. And so what their effort is to expose originalism as a fraud and get to the point where they want to say, well, listen, if you're originalist, you have to believe this. And there's no way that you will believe that. So you'll have to change your methodology, you know, and admit that that system is broken. I think that's where they're going. Because in his podcast, you know, Lessig colorfully stated that their success, quote, will depend upon demonstrating to the Scalia wannabe originalists on the court, those keen to show that their originalism is principled, not just politics, that the original meaning of the First Amendment certainly doesn't give judges the power to strike down laws that advance core and valid anti-corruption or anti-aristocratic ideals. I guess that was not in that podcast. That was in an article that he's written that I don't think it's been published yet. It's got posted on Medium right now.
And they're not entirely wrong, though, right? I mean, this is what's so, you know, the First Amendment as we know it, right? Subjecting contribution limitations to exacting scrutiny, right? That's Buckley. Subjecting disclosure requirements to intermediate scrutiny, but with narrow tailoring, right? These are not originalist concepts, right? The First Amendment doctrines, as we know it, are not, you know, we're born, you know, of fairly recent vintage, let's say. And, you know, just to say it that, you know, with that in mind, are they possibly onto something?
I think that they're possibly onto something that we should look at applying originalism, to the First Amendment. I think Justice Thomas has repeatedly encouraged his colleagues to do so. And he concluded that the free speech clause, you know, as envisioned by Madison, would not allow contribution limits at all. In this case, we've called their bet. So if they're trying to preserve these constitutional arguments, you know, we're doing the same. We put a marker down that will make that originalism argument to the Supreme Court if this case ever gets there.
And I did sort of reflect, we did just get a question typed in here. And we do encourage people, if you do want to submit a question, we will be doing it over the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen. And I think I just sort of alluded to this idea with this, our tiers of scrutiny or First Amendment analysis that is of a wholly modern vintage. You know, should there be deference on top of that, should there be deference to the fact that we didn't see much in the way of First Amendment scrutiny at all by the Supreme Court prior to the early 20th century?
I think that in the doctrines that we have here, you know, we have had periods of time where, you know, the court has been more active and less active in all areas of law. It certainly is true, you know, that it took a while for them to sort of, you know, find their footing and to engage in this. But it doesn't necessarily mean that when they started to do the work, that it wasn't valid. In that time period in the early 1900s, and, you know, they were doing originalism work at the time. You know, they were looking back, you know, at the language itself and how it was interpreted and trying to apply it. That was the method of interpretation that was used by the courts at the time.
And it's also, you know, as far as the campaign finance, right, it's not to say it didn't exist, right, but campaign finance, as we know, it didn't really start to sink in until the progressive era of the early 1910s, right? The State Level Corrupt Practices Act, the Federal Corrupt Practices Act, which were, incidentally, many of them actually just expenditure limitations, really based on an equality interest that used to be what Professor Lessig was all about. though he termed it in some form of anti-corruption, as I recall. But so it's funny that, you know, it is, the issues weren't really in front of, you know, he didn't even exist really in some ways until the early 20th century.
That's right. And, you know, one of the arguments I'm sort of making in this case, maybe a little bit tongue in cheek, maybe not, is that if you think back to the original presidential campaign, you know, the I hesitate to even use the word candidate, you know, the person who stood for election, you know, did not campaign themselves. You know, Washington viewed it very undignified to go around and ask someone for a vote, and would not do so. And then, you know, the other initial candidates, you know, followed suit. So the way that the initial presidential campaigns were run was supporters of these people went out and did the campaigning. So in some ways, the initial campaigns were run only by super PACs. You know, so, you know, maybe it's more akin to political parties, but you get the point, you know, like the third party expenditure, you know, was the way that that it occurred at the founding. And, you know, like more on this point, you know, if you look at the most recent presidential election, you know, sure, Trump won, and sure, he had lots of support from outside his own campaign, you know, but more money was spent against him and supporting Harris than it was spent on his behalf. I believe it was about, you know, total of $1.5 billion on his behalf and $2 billion on her behalf. Now, granted, he only received, you know, he received less than half of what she received as contributions that he could spend. So he did have more money spent on his behalf independently. But the amount that they had spent on their behalf independently was remarkably close. So, you know, I think it's benefiting both sides here. But, you know, one other aspect of this case is that a provision of this ballot initiative also sought to have disclosures of donations all the way down to the $0 threshold for these contributions for independent expenditures. We had that, the district court also struck that down independently. So it didn't strike it down just because it was related to this, but struck it down simply because, you know, there was no limiting principle, if you will. There was no limitation. It was placed upon the threshold. There was no threshold put in there so that there would be no way for somebody to make an anonymous donation if they wanted to.
Yeah, particularly at the state level, it's always, you know, and this is my time as a lobbyist at the state level, but also even in litigation, then just up against the rhetoric in general, when we speak of big money in politics, and then these levels are laughably low, right? When I, you know, in my reading, forgive me, I forget what the threshold here, but the limitation here was what, eight grand or five grand?
5,000.
Yeah, what you could actually contribute. And even in a state level, state like Maine, you know, you want to talk a big money, you want to talk corrupting levels of money. And you're really telling me that our elected leaders are bought and paid for money like that, going into money they can't even touch, but that's going into some organization that's going to say nice things about them or oppose their candidate, right? It has this, I think, a level of skepticism that I think ends up undermining the entire premise. But, you know, to your point, you pivot then, and that's, you know, as we've discussed, this is just verboten under binding First Amendment precedent. I don't think that's really going to change anytime soon. But the more, a far more interesting question is this post Americans for Prosperity Foundation versus Bonta, where the Supreme Court implemented an exacting intermediate scrutiny, but with narrow tailoring to disclosure requirements that the AFPF case was not was not a campaign finance case, but the doctrine quite quickly poured over into a case. You know, I actually worked with some of the folks at Institute for Free Speech, CHIP's organization, on a case, Wyoming Gun Owners versus Gray at the 10th Circuit, I think was one of the first cases to recognize on appeal that, yes, this kind of this type of exacting scrutiny is going to apply to campaign finance disclosure requirements. So having, you know, it almost seems, you know, to your point, Chip, that, yeah, it didn't get struck down just because it's part of the silly and ballot initiative that went, but it's also just independently a $0 threshold, donate, get disclosed, right? Which does tend to, but having said that, right, I don't know if you saw this, I only by accident came upon it, but yesterday, the 10th Circuit, Rio Grande Foundation ruling case out of New Mexico. And it looks to me like, you know, there, I think it's $200 thresholds for segregated accounts, and then a $5,000 threshold for if they're not using, they're just using a general funds, right? So it's very interesting. This is sort of an ongoing, they upheld those requirements under Bonta over a dissent, particularly, I think, as to issue advocacy, right? If you're talking ballot measure stuff, that should have a different kind of disclosure question, right?
Right. So, there's no quid pro quo as possible. Yeah.
Right, right. And so I'm, you know, this is a much more, you know, unlike this expenditure limitation that's just per se going to get struck, this is a much richer, I guess, still a developing area post Bonta, right, for disclosure.
That's right. And, you know, and I think it's an area of law where, you know, we should not shy away from, you know, trying to have originalism applied to, because, you know, look, the reason that they allow these disclosures to occur is so they say that there is the government can pursue an informational interest. You know, like everybody has the right to be a nosy neighbor. And know, you know, what someone else is doing. And the argument goes that, well, if you're lazy and you don't really know what the issues are, you don't research them. If you know who supports it, then, you know, that'll tell you where to go. Well, look, an originalism approach to this is the exact opposite. You know, the founders believed in anonymity and pseudonymity when speaking, and, you know, famously in the debates over the Constitution itself. And they believed in that because, you know, high-mindedly, they thought that ideas should be judged on their merit, not by who said them. So the interest is being, you know, that's been found to be valid for the government here is the exact opposite interest that the founders found important at the time. You know, and so, you know, we certainly hope to continue to work to improve the ability of people to do things anonymously and pseudonymously. And, you know, certainly in modern times, of course, have begun to recognize, you know, in Americans for Prosperity Foundation and others, you know, the harm that can befall, you know, donors and how people can get doxxed and harassed and otherwise, you know, mistreated, or somebody that has a protective order against somebody, you know, they can, their location be disclosed because of this. You know, that so that there are, you know, many interests that should allow for anonymous and pseudonymous activity.
So not only would a founding era citizen balk at the idea that we're going to limit the amount of ink that any newspaper can spend in a city, they probably would balk that it's illegal to publish Pennsylvania Farmer or Cato or any number of the pseudonyms, right? And I think Chip, what you specifically alluded to, I believe, and I don't have the depth here, but my understanding is the authorship of the Federalist was a pretty well guarded secret until maybe the late 1700s, right? So the Constitution had been ratified by the time. There were certainly suspicions, but I think it wasn't really confirmed until it was well after the fact, right? But I've always thought, you know, particularly that the Virginia, while considering the Constitution, which they were distributed hard copies of the bound Federalist, you know, and James Madison, of course, a Virginian, had written many of them, but Alexander Hamilton wrote quite a few of them too. And I can only wonder if that, you know, bastard son New Yorker that could have tainted, right, been used to taint the proceedings, right? So in many ways, we may owe this republic of ours to anonymity, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
So I do want to throw out there, we again, if people do have questions, we do have the Q&A at the bottom. Please feel free to submit anything you'd like. I think we've answered everything that's up so far. So as far as what do you think about the first your time, you know, going up to the First Circuit? I kind of want to ask too many things here. Let's get all jumbled. But you just mentioned doing, you know, depositions. I've seen on the docket you have expert, you know, your own expert witnesses. It looks like David Primo, and of course him and Jeff Milieu have been, you know, the best social scientists ever as far as on campaign finance and whatnot. Do you it used to be, you know, the good old days, which probably never existed, but it used to feel like, you know, in these First Amendment cases, it was sue, do a nice verified complaint, seek a preliminary injunction, get your injunction, and, you know, that's pretty much going to end the case, right? Now, it seems like factual records are something we kind of have to consider going in and by default. And you, I mean, how much is that kind of your posture now, that we're gonna really tackle these cases, knowing we're gonna, you know, not only accepting discovery, but actually kind of itching for it?
Well, so, you know, my view of this is that if there are going to be arguments that are going to be made, that you want to test them. And, you know, up until now, you know, these historians have made arguments via amicus briefs. And sure, you can go and get your kind of counter amici to come out and, you know, and put things on there. But, you know, if because they were put in by declaration here, you know, I thought it was a good idea to go out there and, you know, and depose them and really kind of, you know, test their theories and see why they were saying what they were saying. And, you know, as you would any other expert. And to the extent that that, you know, there are areas of law that are going to be determined more by originalism, I do think that, you know, the ability to really test what the other side is saying by asking them questions versus just putting up your counter speech is a better way to litigate a case.
We have a question just came in that does ask, and I think this goes back to what, you know, it might touch on the emoluments claim, but, you know, and the questioner isn't specific here, but does the same analysis apply to governmental limitations for contributions from foreigners or aggregation of foreign donations? And I guess that might apply to the originalism. And I certainly know it's permissibly and quite restricted under our existing a framework for contributions. And there are certainly movements to do expenditure limitations as well that are completely constitutional under, was it Blumen? Was that the one?
Yeah.
FEC.
That's right. Yeah, you know, like I've not dug into sort of the originalism arguments with respect to limitations on foreign contributions and expenditures. You know, so I can't comment on that, but yeah, under the existing law that's out there, you know, it seems that the court recognizes that is a different creature, and that there can be limitations there.
Yeah, and then I think it's again something that we've seen exploited. You know, and I don't use this word. You know, I think there's a tendency of the reform community to kind of pounce on any opportunity they can to find regulation. Anywhere, right? This was post Citizens United. There's no such thing as an independent expenditure, right? They claim that coordination is sort of a default, which again is completely disconnected from reality. You also had the disclosure fight that is still going on was very much if we can't, you know, censor it, let's put as much red tape on it as possible, particularly disclosure at the lowest threshold we can get away with. And again, this is me projecting, you know, assuming a little bit of bad faith on their part, but you know, the proof is kind of in the pudding. And it seems foreign contributions, foreign money in elections is one that it seems that they don't really, I haven't seen any laws that go as far as, you know, the reformers want, but it gets really messy when you're dealing with, again, with newspapers, because if, you know, Rupert Murdoch is a British national, I think still, but I don't know if he's become an American citizen, but okay. So does that mean it's foreign money in elections, right? I don't think that's the case. But these are areas that they do that have come up, and I've seen a number of states have passed, you know, prohibitions in keeping with the Blumen decision, Blumen versus FEC from the DC Circuit, which was written by Judge Kavanaugh before he was elevated to the Supreme Court a long time back. So it doesn't seem, it seems an interesting like question that I haven't seen really developed since Blumen, but I worry about its exploitation.
Well, there was another ballot initiative in Maine the year before that sought to limit expenditures on ballot initiatives by corporations that were, you know, that had 5% foreign ownership. And that was struck down as well.
Yes. Well, yeah. So I want to apologize. We had another originalist question from our earlier questioner, and I apologize because it's not out of, I'm not trying to ignore you. It's just hard to read through and digest it here. But it seems the social contract historians are teeing up, what they're teeing up is about the respective role of the courts versus the legislature in determining the scope of First Amendment rights. He reiterates the question, isn't the lack of court action on the First Amendment at least somewhat telling? And I guess that's in favor of the social contract people.
Okay, well, so, you know, I view it as a Marbury versus Madison question. When they do that, you know, when they talk about these things and, you know, somewhat the questionnaire puts out there is, you know, like, what's the role of the judiciary? You know, when it says, you know, Congress, you know, shall pass no law, is that something that's to be enforced or not? And, you know, I think that it's been beside this question that the judiciary does have a role to answer that question. But I believe that that's how these questions should be viewed, as a challenge to Marbury versus Madison, you know, not as a manner of interpreting some provision of the Constitution.
I've been asked to give a citation to the New Mexico case. It was literally decided yesterday at the 10th Circuit. So I regret I don't have it, but it's a Rio Grande Foundation. And if you go to the 10th Circuit's website, you should be able to find it with a date search of the last few days. The opinion should come up. So don't have any further questions. So Chip, I see. So going forward, you know, the briefing there's not even a briefing schedule. Is there a briefing schedule yet at the First Circuit?
Yeah, there is a briefing schedule now. Their brief will be due October 22nd.
Okay. So coming up, so probably all things stay on track, oral arguments, hopefully early next year, and then probably hopefully a decision by summertime. Let's be optimistic.
Yeah, I'd be optimistic. You know, I'd say by this time next year.
Excellent. Well, again, I really, really appreciate your time, Chip. I think this is a really fascinating case and developments. And I certainly am glad you're out there doing this fight because, you know, I've been out of it a little while. I've been out of it since Wyoming Gun Owners a few years back, and itching to get back in on a case myself. So you certainly have my thanks and also a good dose of envy that you're doing such great work.
All right. Thanks for having me.
I'll chime in and thank you both. Really appreciate you taking out this section of your days and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.